After a year at Tule Lake, Endo was transferred to the internment camp in Topaz, Utah, where a government official offered her a permit to leave the camp and relocate somewhere outside the West Coast. The government wanted Endo to drop her suit. Endo bravely refused and remained in detention for a total of 3 years. The resistor, whose name would become most famous, Fred Korematsu, provided an unintentional test case. Korematsu, an Oakland native who had worked in his family's flower nursery, was deeply in love with his girlfriend, an Irish-American woman named Ida Boitano. When the order came to report for relocation, Korematsu hid. Then, in an act of real desperation, he subjected himself to plastic surgery to try and hide his Japanese origin. But he was nevertheless turned in after being recognized on the street near the family business and charged with the crime of failing to report. He made bail, only to be rearrested and shipped to Topaz, where his room was a converted horse stall with a single bare bulb. The government of the United States could not have interned the Japanese Americans were it not for the tradition of anti-Asian prejudice in the country in general, and on the West Coast in particular. Although historically the bias was predominantly anti-Chinese, there was no hesitation in deploying stereotypes of the shifty, untrustworthy Oriental onto both first- and second-generation Americans of Japanese origin. Racialized bias was a familiar feature of wartime propaganda going back to World War I, when German Americans were called Huns and subjected to systematic discrimination. The headlines of the period in mainstream newspapers like the Los Angeles Times refer constantly to Japs and Nips, the latter a derogatory contraction of the word Nipponese. The official report on Pearl Harbor, produced by the commission under the chairmanship of Justice Owen Roberts, also helped lay the groundwork for internment. The report asserted that in preparation for the attacks, Japanese spies in Hawaii had gathered information regarding Army and Navy bases there. The report never stated that any of the spies were Japanese Americans. It said only that some were Japanese consular agents, and others were persons having no open relations with the Japanese Foreign Service. The effect of this vague statement about private individuals was to legitimize fear of disloyal Japanese residents of the United States engaging in espionage on behalf of the Japanese government. As the East Coast submarine landings suggest, foreign saboteurs could arrive on U.S. soil. On the West Coast, military concern focused primarily on the possibility that Japanese agents could make radio contact with Japanese naval forces, allowing Japanese submarines to attack ships departing from Pacific ports. Such submarine attacks did occur in the early days of the war with Japan. By February 1942, not quite 2 months after Pearl Harbor, General DeWitt was reporting to his superiors in Washington that he believed the attacks were facilitated by reports from Japanese spies. The FBI, then and later, would maintain that there was no real evidence to support this interpretation of events. Attorney General Francis Biddle opposed the evacuation of U.S. citizens of Japanese origin from the West Coast. But the standards of evidence for wartime judgment are very different from those used in ordinary criminal investigations. Soon after Pearl Harbor, General DeWitt began to advocate a systematic evacuation from the West Coast of all people who were ethnically Japanese. Battlefield paranoia was not the only motive driving DeWitt. He came under intense pressure from leading politicians, including the governor of California, and the state's highest-ranking Republican, Attorney General Earl Warren. Warren was the fastest-rising figure in California politics. He had been nominated attorney general with bipartisan support. Less than a year later, he would be elected governor of the state. He would eventually become Chief Justice of the United States. His influence was significant. After a conversation with Warren, Walter Lippmann wrote one of his nationally syndicated columns calling for the removal of Japanese Americans from the West Coast. That there had as yet been no attacks, wrote Lippmann, was simply a sign that the blow is well organized and held back until it can be struck with maximum effect. Even the New York Times called for serious action. The legal structure adopted to facilitate the internment was a masterpiece of political buck-passing. It began with President Roosevelt, who issued an executive order proclaiming the need to prevent espionage and sabotage, and then authorizing his generals to issue orders of their own accordingly. The order was vague enough that subsequent decisions could not be attributed to the president personally. The military, in turn, ordered the curfew, the exclusion, and the detention. Finally, Congress made it a crime to violate the military's order of evacuation. All this added up to exclusion and relocation to camps under the threat of prison. The whole scheme was designed so that no single legal pronouncement explicitly ordered relocation and internment on racial grounds. The Roosevelt administration and the Army expected legal challenges, and they wanted to win them. For the internees, finding good legal representation turned out to be complicated. The Japanese American Citizens League, the leading national organization for Japanese Americans, had adopted a policy of full cooperation with the government, the better to prove the loyalty of its members. The JACL decided that legal challenges to the internment would not comport with that policy, and so it did not represent the internees who wanted to challenge the law. The National ACLU had made a policy decision not to challenge the constitutionality of the executive order on which the detention rested. Again, a manifestation of wartime loyalty. The Northern California branch of the ACLU represented the pacifist Gordon Hirabayashi, focusing on the curfew order without attacking the detention. Individual lawyers with ACLU ties represented some others, like Mitsuya Endo. Overall, however, the record of even civil libertarians in the history of Japanese-American internment is not gratifying. The first cases to reach the Supreme Court were the challenges to the curfew brought by Minoru Yasui and Gordon Hirabayashi, which were argued in the spring of 1943, just as final opinions were being put in place in the landmark flag salute reversal. In a unanimous decision, with three justices separately concurring, the Supreme Court upheld the curfew against the challenge that it violated the Constitution to impose restrictions on a single class of citizens based upon their racial origin alone. The unanimity reflected both the justices' desire to maintain a united front on an important wartime measure and the powerful drive of loyalty to Roosevelt. Eight of the nine justices sitting on the case had been appointed by Roosevelt, including Harlan Fiske Stone, whom Roosevelt had made Chief Justice. Roberts, the lone Hoover appointee, had chaired the commission whose report had indirectly justified the internment project. Stone took it upon himself to write the opinion. He rested the court's legal position on the government's war power, which was, according to his predecessor, Charles Evans Hughes, the power to wage war successfully. Stone also felt the need to justify the curfew as a reasonable